Asher, Tehran.
Your Honor, Russia are holding a joint maritime rescue and relief exercises in the Caspian Sea aimed at boosting naval coordination with neighboring countries. Our correspondent, Gisu Misha Ahmed, has spoken with drill spokesperson Rear Admiral Mohsen Razoghi at the event's venue.
With the entrance and arrival of the vessels, we have seen the beginning of the CASAREX 2025 with the slogan, "All of us for the secure Caspian Sea." All the vessels have arrived in the premises of the drills, the naval force of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the drills with the attendance of the vessels from the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy and from the Russian Federation and some participants from neighboring countries in the Caspian Sea. And the Islamic Republic of Iran and the naval force of Russia and the naval force of the Islamic Republic is determined to have security and to maintain security, whether in the Caspian Sea and the Persian Gulf and the Oman Sea, with the participation of regional countries and their cooperation, a partnership, and the sympathy of these countries.
Iran has successfully conducted a test launch of a suborbital satellite carrier named the Qasid as part of a developing space program. Tests aimed at assessing emerging technologies currently under development in Iran's space industry. Results are expected to enhance performance of domestic satellites and related systems. The Qasid carrier has been developed by the IRGC Aerospace and designed for faster and more accurate deployments. It was first inaugurated back in 2020 when Iran's new satellite was put into orbit. Rising death toll, ruined homes, and shattered lives. These or Palestinians are enduring in Gaza, where dozens of people have been killed in fresh Israeli attacks since dawn today. Among the new victims, 13 Palestinians who lost their lives in an Israeli artillery attack on tents housing displaced families in Al-Shati refugee camp in Gaza City. Two children also died due to severe malnutrition and lack of essential nutrients. According to Palestinian Red Crescent, nearly 120 wounded Palestinians have been treated now at Al-Quds Hospital in Gaza City since the early hours of this morning. This U.S.-Israeli campaign of genocide, which began in October of 2023, has now killed more than 59,000 Palestinians and left well over 142,000 wounded. And to get a better assessment of the atrocities by the occupation against Palestinians in Gaza throughout the day today, we're going to swing over to our Gaza correspondent in Deir al-Balah, Moti Abu Musab. Moti, good afternoon, pal. Good to check in with you and seeing that you're doing well. What can you share with us?
Yes, actually, I'm really baffled where to begin from, because every single part of Gaza Strip is still witnessing more cruel attacks of the Israeli occupation forces, claiming more lives of the Palestinian civilians, particularly the Palestinian women and children. And let me begin with the major attack that took place in a Shatter refugee camp after the Israeli occupation forces targeted a cluster of the makeshift tents of the displaced people there, killing at least 14 Palestinian civilians. Many of them were women and children. The dead bodies were found completely charred and, as you know, shredded beyond recognition because they were targeted indiscriminately by the Israeli artillery. This is another horrific massacre unfolded in that area, and it is added to the ongoing and ceaseless Israeli massacres that are committed day and night against the Palestinian people. Meanwhile, two other Palestinian dead bodies were extracted from the rubble of the destroyed houses in Jabalia refugee camp. And here in the central area of Gaza, as you know, the current situation is still disastrous, and it is precarious, particularly in Deir al-Balah city amid the ongoing military offensive, which targets the southern outskirts of Deir al-Balah city. We are talking about ceaseless and uninterrupted Israeli brutal air strikes and attacks, in addition to the artillery strikes, which are still ongoing and abated, targeting those areas. Those attacks are still ongoing for more than 48 hours without any cessation. At least 25 Palestinian residential buildings were completely destroyed and pummeled by the Israeli warplanes. In addition to that, as you know, the Israeli bolts of fire are still repetitive, targeting the area. Hundreds of thousands of the Palestinian people were forcibly expelled out of those, as you know, shelters that they were taken inside that area. So the current situation is absolutely horrific, and it is very cruel for the Palestinian people in Deir el-Balah city. And till this moment, we are able to hear those deafening bombardments resulted in from the chronic and extensive artillery shelling maintained against that area. Let me remind you that Deir el-Balah city was claimed since the start of this genocidal onslaught till this moment as a safe zone for the Palestinian people. They have demanded, the Israeli occupation forces have demanded the Palestinian people to go to Deir el-Balah city, claiming that it is a safe place. And now they are attacking Deir el-Balah city directly. We are talking about roughly 40% of the entire area of Deir el-Balah city was demanded to be fully evacuated from the Palestinian people. But unfortunately, the people don't have any place to go to amid these prevalent and ubiquitous attacks are still covering everywhere in Gaza Strip. And what is really horrific and excruciating for the Palestinian people is that they are no longer able to move from a place to another place. They are absolutely exhausted and they are frail from starvation, from dehydration, from the catastrophic humanitarian conditions. They don't have anything to eat. They don't have transportations. They don't have anything to help them just to endure this unbearable pressure maintained by the Israeli occupation forces. And even when it comes to the southern parts of Gaza Strip, the Israeli attacks against Al-Mawasa area were continued over the last night. Another attack took place there, claiming the lives of three Palestinian civilians after they were targeted by the Israeli occupation forces. While when it comes to the aid seekers, they were also targeted by the Israeli occupation forces. At least eight Palestinian aid seekers were killed and slaughtered after they were targeted point blank by the Israeli mass shooting and the gunfire near those notorious and abhorrent aid distribution centers in the western side of Rafah City. So once again, the Israeli occupation forces are still escalating their brutal air strikes and attacks. The mass killing of the Palestinian people is still underway and abated, while the starvation hits the Palestinian people everywhere in Gaza Strip. According to the last update of the Gaza Health Ministry, we are talking about roughly 21 Palestinian civilians died of hunger and famine in less than 24 hours. The last two babies died today as a result of that malnutrition. One of them was four months old baby. So the current situation is apocalyptic for the Palestinian people. Meanwhile, as you know, the Al-Shifa Medical Complex announced that the dialysis department is out of service now because of the lack of the fuel those hospitals need to operate and function amid these unbearable and unendurable conditions that the Israeli occupation forces are still inflicting upon the Palestinian people in all areas of Gaza Strip.
All right, well, thank you for that comprehensive update, Moti, and stay safe there, pal. Moti Abu Musaba joining us from central Gaza. Meanwhile, the United Nations has expressed a deep concern over the breakdown of humanitarian conditions in Gaza, condemning Israel's targeting of starving Palestinians seeking aid in the besieged strip.
The Secretary General is appalled by the accelerating breakdown of humanitarian conditions in Gaza, where the last lifelines keeping people alive are collapsing. He deplores the growing reports of children and adults suffering from malnutrition. The Secretary General strongly condemns the ongoing violence, including the shooting, the killing, and the injuring of people attempting to get food for their families. Civilians must be protected, civilians must be respected, and they must never, ever be targeted.
Dujarric said that civilians must be protected and respected, and added that Israel must allow and facilitate humanitarian relief provided by the UN and other humanitarian organizations. He said Israel's evacuation order in parts of Deir el-Balah has restricted the UN's ability to deliver life-saving aid. And on Monday, the World Health Organization said Israeli military attacked its staff residence and main warehouse in Deir el-Balah. The UN Health Agency warned the evacuation order in the city has affected several WHO premises, compromising agencies' ability to operate there in Gaza. Two more Israeli soldiers have been killed in Gaza, marking yet another setback for regime's military and ongoing confrontations with Palestinian resistance. According to Israeli media, 19-year-old Staff Sergeant Amit Cohen from the Golani Brigade's 13th Battalion was killed in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Another incident, an occupation force reservist was killed in Gaza fighting. According to Israeli media, his killing took place after a blast caused a building to collapse. New fatalities come as Palestinian resistance continues to put up fierce resistance against occupying forces, inflicting heavy losses on them. Regime's authorities often conceal the true scale of troop losses in Gaza amid growing criticism of this ongoing campaign of genocide. Estimates suggest around 900 Israeli soldiers have been killed in Gaza since October of 2023. Yemeni armed forces have carried out yet another retaliatory operation against Israel, targeting Ben Gurion Airport with a hypersonic missile.
In support of the oppressed Palestinian people and the resistance fighters, and in response to the crime of genocide perpetrated by the Zionist enemy against our people in the Gaza Strip, the missile force of the Yemeni armed forces carried out a qualitative military operation targeting Ben Gurion Airport in the occupied Yaffa region using a Palestine 2 hypersonic ballistic missile.
Saudi said the operation successfully achieved its goal and halted the airport's operation, adding missile strike force Israeli residents to also have to flee to local shelters there. A spokesman also praised the Yemeni people for supporting oppressed Palestinians amid the Gaza genocide. Saudi underlined Yemen's anti-Israel operations will continue as long as the genocide in Gaza persists and Israel keeps up its blockade on the territory. The latest retaliatory operation was launched following a drone strike by the Israeli military on Yemen's port city of Hodeidah. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Streets and lanes, and heal the scars. Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and a very warm welcome to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing and I'm your host Zainab, grateful to be here with you hosting another episode of Islamic Upbringing. Well, in this program, we try to reconnect with our purpose as parents, as guides, as mentors, while with the teachings and valuable insights of our guest speakers who give us advices based on the Holy Quran and the sayings of Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, and the guidance from our noble imams. Well, joining us is Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas, a scholar whose insights promise to illuminate this subject beautifully because he's known for his deep understanding of both Islamic teachings and modern psychology. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, technology, when technology comes, a lot of opportunities and at the same time, a lot of challenges come up, a lot of distrust and also sometimes reliance, a lot of things mixed together come up. So we'll discuss how technology has effect on our youth and also how parents can help their children to use technology properly. Brother Liaqat Abbas, talking of tech, how do we deal with the youth and tech?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When it comes to technology, when it comes to social media, internet, everything, I remember a scholar who said, internet is like a knife. It is useful, but it is dangerous.
At the same time.
Yeah, exactly. So keeping this in mind, it's like a knife. So you don't want to give the knife to your child just like that, who doesn't know how to use. Either you be with your child, okay, who is not knowing how to use it properly, or you teach him how to use it properly.
Right.
Okay. So that shenacht or that understanding should be there.
That like knowledge for the
child.
Of use.
Yeah, exactly. Of how to use. Only then, of course, you can leave your child. Mm-hmm. But not just like that. You still have to have a proper monitoring upon your child or youth, example. So the solution to it is like you can set up time limits, like maximum 2 hours a day or 1 hour a day, looking at the child's schedule. It is the best if you can keep your child completely occupied the whole day.
Right.
This is the best thing which you can do.
To keep them occupied.
To keep them occupied, like be it with swimming classes or pottery classes, I don't know, like tuitions and
play. So are you trying to say that children usually go towards tech when they are usually free?
Yes, of course. Yeah. If they are free, they tend to go towards playing games, online games or like offline games as well. And social media, which is really bad.
And parents really know what kind of things pop up when they are just using the
games.
You
know, it's not just about popping up. Yes, of course, popping up is a bad thing, which is there. Even inside the games, there's a lot of like explicit thing, content inside the games as well.
Parents cannot imagine.
Yeah, the parents can't even imagine, unfortunately.
Because games. Mothers sometimes, like mothers when or fathers, when they are doing some important job, they want to focus on something and at the same time a child is irritating, they try to give away their phone and then they leave them
they
on their own state.
They try to give away their phone or the child turns on a game.
Majority number of times, this is the thing that happens. Like I usually have seen like when children are using phone, like especially very, very young children, they are usually like when parents want to focus on something.
Yeah. And the games in today's world are created in such a manner, unfortunately, that there are bad contents like inside the game, which a child might not know. even the parents, because they think, oh, it's just a car game. Oh, it's just a normal game, okay?
But they don't know the Barbie who pops up and, you know, raises the flag is in the very immodest clothes.
Exactly, yeah. Unfortunately, it's not just till that extent. Like, it goes beyond that, unfortunately. Yeah. The modesty is not there inside the games. I won't say all the games don't have modesty, but there are games which a parent should know beforehand itself. Like, okay, this game is good or bad for my child. Okay, if it is not good, then try to kind of get rid of it, probably.
Right. Okay. So let's take a short break, and before we delve more and explore some more about the tech and our kids.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman. Don't give in to Shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsinin, wa Khaliquna, wa Rasiquna, wa Huwa ala kulli shay'in qadir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat Abbas is here, and we're discussing the tech and our youth and our kids. So, yeah.
So, example, you can have parental control apps, example, where you can control without your child knowing, okay, because it's not always good that the child knows everything that you are monitoring completely or whatever. Example, or keeping the monitor or the PC in the hall itself, okay, where you are present, okay. Even if you're doing your job over there, you are having an eye on your child. What is the child doing?
All right, example. So you are saying like taking away phones from them or completely cutting off the access to tech is not a good thing. It's not a wise thing as well.
Why? Because that's the reason I told you, like, set a time limit, yeah? In that time limit in a day, of course, they have to learn. Maybe what you can do is you can keep that 1 hour or 2 hours for them to learn new things, new program, or like video editing, example, or photo editing, something like this, example.
Yeah, I remember like a few days ago, I was teaching my son that there's something called as AI, and I'll show you how to chat with it. He was amazed. Like, is it something? Is a machine answering us? Is there some human sitting behind? So, like, a lot of curious questions and interesting questions popped up in his mind. But yes, like, I was all the time with him and telling him, like, come on, ask. And
this is the good thing about you, that you were with him. Why? Because, you know, there might be a question in his mind. Example, I'm not talking about like a child, okay?
Right.
A child's mind, which, if put forward, okay, in a different manner, then the answer might not be like Islamic.
Yeah, because we do not rely on these things, because not the AI, we don't think that it's not biased. We definitely think that it's a biased thing and something not Islamic, definitely all the time. But yes, informative at the same time.
It is informative. The child should know, but in limits.
Yeah.
And of course, like in the, I would say, in the monitoring of the parents, I would say. Just like you were there when you were teaching AI to your child. That's the amazing, that's a beautiful thing. Why? Because you are there to correct the child. You know what? This thing which he has said is wrong.
Like, yeah, I don't give access to my children to use the internet or AI or whatever, except my presence. Like, because everything is on my PC, on my system, and I have to be there. I can't let my PC go and do something else.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing. That's the most beautiful thing what we as parents can do. And you know, there are Islamic alternatives as well, like faith-based video games. Alhamdulillah, like Iran has been creating quite a few now, and I think this is a good option and alternative. Why? Because what the child really wants is just a game. Okay, it doesn't matter what is there inside. Like, okay, it should be attractive and everything, that's there for sure. But other than that, like, he wants to play the game. He wants to feel that he is doing that stuff.
Entertainment,
the entertainment part is the most important thing in the game. and which can be I would say attained even with an Islamic game, something like faith-based Islamic game or something like this, which alhamdulillah Iran has been creating. I would say the parents to try to get in contact with the people you know over here and try to get those video games like in DVDs and stuff, so that like, and of course spread over there, that's a good thing, yeah, like spread among the Muslimin, like spread amongst your communities, inshallah, right. You'll get a lot of rewards for this.
Indeed. So let's take a short break here and we'll discuss more.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brotherly Akut Abbas is here helping us understand the valuable insights from Islamic upbringing. So we're talking about tech and our kids. And now, like, if we come back to youth, the young generation and the, like, teenagers, if I say. I just recently saw a video clip where a teenager was showing ChatGPT voice mode to his mom, and he was saying, like, you can talk to her and she will answer any question. So, like, the mother was also like, she extended salam, and then her son was like, why are you doing salam to her? It's not like it's a machine. So she was like, shut up, we have this in our deen, like, we have to say salam to everyone. So that was really funny video, but at the same time, like, the moment she asked her the criteria for something, and the AI came up with a lot of stuff. And then she was like, she's really, really informative. And where do such kind of girls come from? So, like, you know, sometimes teenagers could also be a source to teach their parents about different tech and apps.
Yep, definitely. And, you know, when it comes to technology and applications like apps and social media, over here is the place where the parents has to be extra cautious. Why? Because if it is a child, you can still have a kind of upper hand on the child, like you are there. But if it is a youth, example, an adolescent or teen, example, there the teen might not like you indulging in all the affairs or of the teen, of the youth. Yeah, example, what are the chats with which the teen is like? To whom is he chatting to? Yeah, example. In Insta, what are the posts?
So, do you suggest like parents should be having a friendly bond than a very having that gap?
Exactly. This is what I want to say. Like, bringing the parent into the shoes of the teen is very important.
All right.
And it's very difficult as well. Like, think from a teen's perspective. Because today's world is the world of technology. So it's like, it's very important for the parent to know what the teen is going through in the social media. Example, if you have a friendly bond with your teen, then it's easy for you to take the phone of the child or the teen, yeah, and go through the social content of what he's going through or she's going through. But if there's no bond, then you can't ask the phone of your teen. Example, yeah, example, your teen is 18 now and you want to go through, okay,
Content your teen is using, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if you have this friendly bond, you'll be like, let's watch together. Okay, yeah. Let's like sit beside me.
So the thing that you suggest for the parents when it comes to adolescents using tech, you're saying that make a friendly bond so that, you know, they are very friendly with you and they don't have any distance and gaps, and they respect, you also respect.
Because you can't stop teen from everything. You can stop the child, but you can't stop the teen.
So it's very way better to teach them, you know, a modesty and their privacy as well, and other parts of life. Thank you, brother, for being with us. It's a deep topic, but that's all the time we had for today. Thank you, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another episode, take good care. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the United Nations building in New York, there is a never-ending stream of shocks and horrors that pass over diplomats' desks. And in recent years, those shocks and horrors seem to be escalating to new levels. The conflict in Ukraine, the apocalyptic scenes of Gaza, and the 12-day war between Iran and Israel, the specter of wider global conflict lurks ever-present. To discuss all this today on the Moscow Report, I'm speaking to Dmitry Polyansky, the Deputy Russian Ambassador to the United Nations. In particular, focus is the recent war between Iran and Israel and what role Russia is willing to play to secure peace in the region. Mr. Polyansky, thank you for joining me. First of all, were you shocked? Have you been shocked the last year or so from the images of Gaza? And how keen is the delegation of the Russian Federation to end what's happening there?
Well, of course, we all were shocked and we continue to be shocked and demanding immediate ceasefire. We think that what is happening in Gaza is absolutely unacceptable. And Russian delegation was the first one to propose draft resolution demanding immediate ceasefire. It was 1 week after the events of 7th of October 2023. So we are very consistent and we are coordinating our efforts with our Arab partners and all those who are not willing to close their eyes on what's happening there.
And what is it like in the corridors of the United Nations? Obviously, you've got conflicts, wars, constantly going through the building. Is there something different about what's happening in Gaza? Is there more of a feeling amongst many people there that this has to stop, or is it just another conflict?
Well, it's very disturbing for everybody to see what's happening, and you need to take into account the fact that UN is first and foremost a dialogue platform, bringing together different countries and opinions, and if there is a consensus, if there is a desire to move forward, then UN can envisage certain action, including by the use of force, in accordance with Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. But otherwise, it all boils down to discussions and exchange of opinions, condemnation, emotions, and of course it affects a lot of people, a lot of my colleagues who are very desperate and anxious because of the fact that we were not able to make difference on the ground, to bring about any practical result, regardless of the fact that we all were working painstakingly and we consider to work painstakingly on such a scenario. But you know that the Security Council was blocked by the U.S. delegation on many occasions as far as Gaza situation is concerned.
And in terms of the 12-day war, as it's being called, between Iran and Israel, how concerned was the Russian delegation in that conflict? People like Jeffrey Sachs, the renowned academic, said that war with Iran would be World War III. How concerned were you, and indeed are you, as the conflict might start again,
of war between Israel and Iran?
Well, first of all, we were predicting that such developments is not excluded because of the way the events folded out. Gaza provocations, inflammatory rhetoric, all this in combination left very little grounds for optimism. And we were repeatedly telling about this during our meetings with on the topic of Gaza, on Lebanon, on other issues. We were also very much concerned by the fact that that some Western delegations were trying to bring more emotions about this file in Vienna and working in the IAEA to kind of create atmosphere which would be very dangerous. And this was visible. This was coming. This was looming. And that's why we were absolutely correct when we said that the region is facing very, very dire times. So unfortunately, we were right. When it all happened, we immediately supported the demand of our Iranian colleagues for emergency Security Council meeting. And I think that we were also very consistent during this meeting, during our interviews, during any statements of our foreign minister, president, official spokesperson, about the fact, about the condemnation of this aggression, unprovoked aggression against Islamic Republic of Iran, and we were absolutely clear and unambiguous about this from day one.
There is some feeling amongst some people, I don't know about the Iranian government, but some people in Iran and indeed internationally, that Russia perhaps didn't do enough for Iran when the conflict started. Obviously, Iran has been quite supportive to Russia. We don't know how or in what capacity in the conflict in Ukraine. But would you accept that or not? Do you think Russia has fulfilled its obligations, if it has any, to Iran?
I would put it this way. We did everything that Iran asked us to do. I think that Iranians can't reproach us of any lack of support, of any ambiguity, and we were all the time supporting Iran at international forums during Security Council meeting. And I think that that is very important. And our Iranian colleagues here, the permanent mission of Iran to the UN, are very grateful to us, and we continue day-to-day coordination at expert level, and I haven't heard of any reproaches to us or some wishes that we didn't implement.
Russia seems to be trying to strike a balance in the Middle East. Obviously, you have friendly relations with Israel, you have important trade ties with Israel, and of course with Iran. Have relations between the Russian Federation and Israel been damaged over recent years, obviously because of Ukraine, then Gaza, now Iran? How is Russia's relationship with Israel at the moment?
We try to remain in contact with all the stakeholders in the region, and that gives us a unique opportunity for good offices and for reaching out to different players, which I think is very important nowadays. Here we, in fact, have some kind of a unique position. We are very blatant when we speak with our Israeli colleagues, telling that a lot of things that they are doing are unacceptable. We have been consistently critical of the lack of desire and readiness from Israel to implement the decisions of International Community, Security Council, General Assembly, as regards the creation of independent Palestinian state. And we're not ambiguous about this. On the other hand, we have some practical issues that we discuss in our bilateral relations with Israel. We have to bear in mind that a big proportion of Israelis are Russian speakers, and they originated from the countries of the former Soviet Union. So they share, to a large extent, they share a mentality, and, we have a lot of things in common. This is a factor which we can't ignore, and we try to be balanced again. But it doesn't mean that we want to kind of be politically more polite or put something sweep something under the rug because of some practical consideration with that or that side of conflict in the Middle East.
At the United Nations, you see quite a bit of Iranian diplomacy up close. Right now, there's some confusion or ambiguity about whether Iran wants to negotiate. Do you feel the Iranians want to find a deal with the Americans to try to find a long-lasting solution to the nuclear program and indeed peace in the region?
My impression is that Iran was always open. Iran was always ready to find a solution. It was not Iran which triggered this whole degradation of situation around JCPOA. We all remember that it was the decision of the previous Trump administration to withdraw from this deal, which started all this circle of problems. And we still call it the European relevant meetings of the Security Council. We don't want it because the United States and its Western partners, they usually try to, you know, say that all the problems emanate from the actions of Iran, forgetting that these actions were retaliatory and that they would be easily reviewed and for many, many months and even years, everybody was trying to find a way forward with the JCPOA, but unfortunately it was not the case. I always felt from my colleagues at the Iranian mission genuine desire for diplomacy. They were always ready. They were calling spade a spade, of course, as everybody concerned about the true source of this crisis. And here, of course, they were not on the same page with the United States and other countries, but they were on the same page with the truth, and that's most important. So I'm not aware of which role Iranian mission, for example, plays, if it does play any role in bilateral contacts, direct or indirect, with the United States. I simply don't have this kind of knowledge. But I know that as far as the UN agenda is concerned, Iranian mission here is very active. They have very professional diplomats, very professional and respected ambassador who has a lot of contacts, and we assist them. We always maintain close contact at all levels, and frankly, I don't recall any contradictions or any problematic issues that we didn't manage to solve in a very partner-like way through diplomacy, mostly at expert level. I think that's how the missions should interact here in New York.
And how, just to give us some inside kind of picture, how do the Iranians and the Americans, for example, interact at the United Nations? I mean, do they interact at all? Do they have any honest dialogue in the corridors?
I haven't seen any dialogue between Iranian mission and U.S. mission. If it takes place, well, first of all, we do not monitor it, of course. We do not stalk Iranians or Americans about their contacts, and we hope that nobody stalks us on what we're doing or not doing. I recall at some point of time there was very historic reaching out, I think, of Linda Thomas-Greenfield to the Iranian ambassador front of the cameras, only once that I remember that it was happening. Otherwise, I think that there is no direct interaction, but they very often are present during the same meetings. They are sitting at the same horseshoe table, and they do not address each other directly, but this crosstalk is not kind of a tradition of the Security Council meetings, especially closed meetings. That's why Iranian delegation behaves in the way it should behave. And again, I can't really account for any direct interactions that I was aware of between them. Usually it's just, you know, in the framework of the Security Council meetings, which involve these two countries.
There was a lot of hope when the new Trump administration took power. he was very clear that he wanted peace both in Ukraine and in the Middle East. Do you get a sense that there is a change of American policy, or is it simply more of the same?
No, it's hard to say at this stage, because frankly, we don't understand at this moment quite clearly what is the new U.S. Foreign policy, including towards the UN, because there are a lot of signals that United States is in favor of scaling down expenditures here in the UN, doing away with red tape, all these things that we all share. But devil is in the details, of course. So far, we don't have a new U.S. ambassador, Mr. Waltz. As far as I know, he wasn't even affirmed by the Congress at this stage. The current acting head of mission does her best. She reflects the priorities of the Trump administration. But everybody understands that a new ambassador who has Mr. Trump's ear and direct contact maybe would give us more clarity about the priorities of the new administration. So far, they are very blurry and controversial, and I think that U.S. foreign policy still is very mercurious and hard to predict. These policies are in the making, and I hope that at some moment we will better understand what will be the line of the United States in the world and in the United Nations. So far, it's not very clear.
Because it seems under Biden, everybody knew what they were getting. It was very clear their policy on Ukraine. They wanted the war to continue on Israel. But Trump, you do get a sense as a diplomat of the United Nations that you don't really know what American policy is.
On certain things, it's predictable. Like in the Middle East, I think it was predictable from day one. There are, of course, nuances in approaches of two administrations. But in general, the pattern remains the same. It's the safeguard of Israeli interests and support of Israel as the main key ally in the Middle East. Some other files were predictable. I think that Iranian file as well was one of the most obvious, obvious targets of Trump administration, given his previous record and given his personal positions. On some other issues, like, for example, Ukraine, still there are very many emotions and very, I would say, little consistency sometimes, because we have repeatedly told President Trump at several levels and his team that in order to achieve a long-lasting peace, sustainable peace in Ukraine, we need to address the root causes of this crisis. And this was the core of our approach, and this still is the core of our approach. Sometimes we have the impression that U.S. side is understandable, is understanding to this obvious thing. Sometimes, if we try to analyze some other statements, there are a few reasons to believe in such a way of thought. But again, it's all in the making.
And do you think Russia and Iran both, in a way, have been fooled by the thoughts of peace talks from the United States? Do you have faith still in peace talks with the United States over Ukraine? And do you think Iran could still have faith in peace talks with the United States over their policy?
Look, we are diplomats, and we should be mindful of positions of the other side, and we need to find compromise by at the same time defending and safeguarding our own positions. So we have no illusions that the Trump administration and President Trump himself, when he makes any move, he is first and foremost guided by the U.S. interests. It would be strange if by acting so, he would be guided by Russian interests or Ukrainian interests or Iranian interests. Everybody has its own interests. So that's why we have no illusions about this. We understand that President Trump, as far as Russia and Ukraine are concerned, we have the impression that President Trump has genuine desire to stop this war, these hostilities, and to bring the situation to the peaceful course of the events. For for reasons that may be not very much clear and which may not be totally coinciding with our interests. But this is a welcome move, and we from the outset welcomed the desire of Trump administration and President Trump himself to bring about a peaceful solution. Some people, I understand, may be getting impatient in Washington. Some people might be trying to kind of undermine U.S. participation in any peaceful efforts. But the general line, I think, remains still very clear that the U.S. wants to assist Russia and Ukraine in finding a solution to this crisis. And here we are on the same page with the U.S. administration in terms of tactics and in terms of what should be done. But of course, again, devil is in the details. And again, there are too many actors, too many countries which would not be absolutely interested in the true, genuine, peaceful effort to stop hostilities. It's up to them to decide. We know that we can count on our country, on our partners and allies, and that we are ready to have a diplomatic solution to this crisis. At the same time, we are ready to achieve the goals of our special military operation by military means, and that's something that we were consistently reiterating from day one of our special military operation, and we are at the same situation right now.
It's been very sad for me as a British journalist. I've been reporting on this conflict in Ukraine for the last 3 years of seeing European policy, how it's damaged British and European interests, in my view, and the standards of British and European politicians doesn't seem to be what it was 20 years ago. I've met incredible diplomats, are some of my favorite people. I've met them, African people all around the world, very nice people. I met some very impressive British diplomats as well. But you may not be able to, you may be too diplomatic to answer this question, but how do you rate the standard of British and European diplomacy now? Is it the standard of it was 20 years ago? Do you believe it is helping to pursue British and European interests?
I think that they have dwarfed very much the standards of diplomacy, and they are based, first of all, on Russophobia. That's quite clear, and they were based on Russophobia even before the start of our special military operation. They lack strategic vision, that's also for sure. I recall dealing with British and European diplomats 20 years ago. They strategic vision. They had an understanding of where they are heading, why they need Russia, why they need to cooperate with Russia. It doesn't mean that they were fond of Russia. It doesn't mean that they were supportive of what we are doing. They were critical on certain things. We were critical on many other things, which, by the way, came true. Everything that we were critical on predicted, it materialized. But now it's very difficult to speak to the European diplomats, with a very few exceptions, and regardless of the fact that the UK had very considerable, I would say, and respected diplomatic school, now it's very hard sometimes to speak to the UK diplomats, because instead of being a diplomat, they turned into some kind of propagandists and Russophobes. Of course, it's very hard to find any common grounds with such people, even for us. They were betting on Russia being defeated. I don't know who kind of introduced this kind of strategic delusion in their hands, in their heads. But many of them are still sticking to this absolutely futile concept. And I don't know when will they be cured out of it. So on such basis, of course, it's very hard to find any understanding, any common ground. But I believe that at some point we will be able to come back to normal, at least dialogue, and at least when Europe will more or less group its strategic interests and priorities, which would help us a lot.
Do you believe that Britain, the British and European governments, and indeed missions, diplomatic missions, are acting in British and European interests? It seems to many, including myself, that they are not acting in British and European interests. And even your president, Vladimir Putin, I think perhaps is even confused into this. why is Britain and Europe not acting in their national interests? It doesn't seem like they are.
It's very hard for me to understand what is the national interests of UK and Europe. Now, I really can't understand what are the motives, apart from very blatant Russophobia and real hatred towards my country. I don't see any kind of, you know, other tunes in their heads. Maybe this is temporary. Maybe this is some kind of illusion. I met a lot of people even here in the UN, from the UK, from Europe, who regret very much this state of things. I will not, of course, tell you their names, because they may face certain problems back home. But there are people who understand that this is not the way it should develop. But so far, we are where we are. And I don't see, in terms of Europe, I don't see even the light at the end of the tunnel, because they still stick to this futile hope of inflicting strategic defeat on Russia. They still stick to this absolutely mistaken concept of zero-sum games, that either Russia or Europe should win, and the winner takes it all. We were always again this type of concepts. We think that everybody could benefit of our mutually beneficial and good neighborly relations and cooperation. And we were not the ones who spoiled all this. We were not the ones who brought Russophobia into the bloc. It was the consequence of enlargement of the European Union. It was consequence of people with their agenda, Russophobic agenda, coming there and poisoning the whole narrative of European Union. It's happened gradually, and unfortunately, Europeans were short-sighted enough to kind of let it happen.
And final question, is it in Russia's interests for there to be peace between Iran and Israel and the United States, and what can you do about it?
Absolutely. This is not only in Russia's interest. I think this is in the interest of the whole world. And we were always saying, and we continue to say, that we would be very much interested in the direct dialogue between United States and Iran to find the way out of the current crisis. We are ready for any format to support this. We stick to the JCPOA. We stick to other situations. We think that Israel has the right to exist, and Israel has the right to live in security with its neighbors. So this is one of the basic facts that we always say. But at the same time, it shouldn't neglect the plight of Palestinian people. There should be a two-state solution. It should be, and this is something that would entail, I think, a lot of good things for the region as such, because the fact that Palestinian issue is not settled is something that prevents a lot of positive processes to happen in the Middle East or elsewhere. So this is the key key to every door or every positive door in the Middle East. But so far, what we hear from Israel, from the United States, is not very encouraging, because two-state solution as a concept is not popular in both countries, and it's our task to kind of reinvigorate the true diplomatic efforts to the sustainable and fair solution of many problematic issues in the Middle East, including the Iranian issue, including the issue of two-state solution, Lebanon, Yemen, you name it. There are a lot of, unfortunately, crisis situations in the Middle East, and all of them are pinned on the fact that Palestinian problem remains an open wound for the region, and people feel it. And so this sense of injustice, of course, is dominating the emotions and any